These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO Concord 89.1.
WEVS Nashua 88.3.
WEVH Hanover 91.3.
WEVN Keene 90.7.
WEVC Gorham 107.1.
WEVJ Jackson 99.5.
WEVF Colebrook 90.3.
And WEVQ Littleton 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. The New Hampshire Senate advances a bill that would restrict voting eligibility in the state. Senator Jean Shaheen endorses Molly Kelly for governor. And the school choice bill. For a short time, it was considered dead, but late yesterday, lawmakers injected a little life into what was supposed to be the centerpiece of Governor Chris Sununu's education agenda for this year. These and other stories made headlines this week, and we will talk about them in this hour. You can call into The Exchange at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send an email to exchange at nhpr.org. Or post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange. That's all one word. And we are streaming a live video of this radio show, which you can watch at our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. And here to talk about the week's news and answer your questions are Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, NHPR's Casey McDermott, and Dave Solomon of the Union Leader. Thank you, everybody, for being here.
Glad to be here.
Hi, Peter.
So the phone number again for you to call, 1-800-892-6477. And we're going to start with the breaking news story of the day, which is that the school choice bill is not dead yet. The bill, known as SB 193, would allow public dollars to follow some students to private schools. The House had voted to send it to interim study, voted not to reconsider it for this year, but it is alive again. Dave, what gave this bill new life?
Well, Peter, it's somewhat of a surprise that it still has legs, but not entirely unanticipated. After the House voted down the bill for the first time on Wednesday, it was widely acknowledged that that certainly wasn't the end. Another vote was anticipated on Thursday. It was widely assumed that the Republicans would like to take another bite at that apple, hoping that they could get more members in attendance and perhaps obtain a different result. What was really interesting on Thursday was right off the bat, as the session convened, it was not a Republican member who brought the reconsideration forward, but the Democratic leader in the House, Stephen Shurtleff, actually moved for reconsideration, indicating that the Democrats were fairly confident they still had enough Republicans in the House to defeat it a second time, and they did, by a slightly narrower margin. And so it was still not thought to be the final word because among those familiar with parliamentary procedure, it was widely understood that the Senate was still in session, still voting on that day, yesterday, and still had an opportunity to attach some version of this school choice bill as an amendment to a House bill it was considering, thus setting the stage for a conference committee in which the Senate representatives will essentially say to the House, well, if you want this charter school bill passed that we passed as well, you'll have to take our amendment on it and bring it back to your members for another vote. And I think since these conference committees are controlled largely by the majority party, that we will see a third vote in the House on this measure.
And what is the shape of this measure as an amendment? Is it much different
from
the bill?
I believe it's the original Senate bill that Senator John Reagan presented and that has since been substantially changed in the House. But I don't think that really matters. I think that's just a placeholder. I think that when it gets to conference committee, that the Senate would gladly take the House version or any version of this plan that they could get back to the House floor.
Okay. And Dean, what do you make of this?
Yeah, this has been an important part of Governor Sununu's agenda. He's been pushing for it quite hard. It's something he really wants to see the state legislature pass. And We've talked in recent months about the popularity of these kinds of measures in Republican legislatures around the country. As state legislatures have trended more Republican in recent years, with Donald Trump becoming president and appointing Betsy DeVos to Secretary of Education, I think the school vouchers, community of school vouchers supporters has felt more energized than we've seen in a long time. And it is true that this bill has been chipped away at it a number of different ways before the votes in the House this week. So it was a more limited bill. There's still some complications with an inclusion of, I believe, religious schools are still included in this, and there's been some question about the constitutionality of that. So you know, we'll see what happens in the House, but there's no doubt there's been kind of a renewed push among Republicans around the country for these kinds of voucher programs in a way that I haven't seen in a long time.
The language is somewhat politicized too, right? I mean, the supporters of this program call it freedom scholarships. Is that right?
That's the name of the bill.
Yeah. So worth mentioning. But Governor Sununu must be pretty happy about this.
Well, he's happy he's going to get a third shot because this is really huge. And I don't recall seeing so much of a full court press for an individual piece of legislation in recent memory. Governor Sununu has disavowed any national political ambitions, but he clearly wants to be propelled on the national stage as a leading advocate of school choice. We've got the Secretary of Education, Betty DeVos, coming here to New Hampshire for a GOP fundraiser in the near future. I've heard a lot of discussion centering on speculation that there was big hope that her arrival here could serve as a platform for her to both applaud the New Hampshire initiative, which everyone thought would have been passed by then, and to also potentially announce a national initiative to allow some of the federal education money to follow students wherever they may go. It now looks that the last thing that Governor Sununu wants when Betty DeVos arrives here is a school choice bill in shambles. So the pressure is intense.
Republican Neil Kirk opposed the bill creating the school choice program based on education savings accounts. Let's hear from him.
The net effect, local property taxpayers are going to have to raise additional tax dollars to offset the loss of state revenue.
Neil Kirk talking about opposition to this. Apparently that issue that he raises will be hammered out later on in the process, possibly.
Well, the extent to which the public schools would be able to have their loss of revenue made up or mitigated in some fashion has changed as the bill evolved. It started with a stabilization fund that would have assured them restoration of state, a full restoration of any lost state education money up to 0.25% of their previous budget. So let's call that full restoration for the initial years of the program. That's how the bill passed the House the first time. Then it got to the House Finance Committee for a second review, and that stabilization fund was removed in Finance Committee amendments and replaced by a one-time payment of $1,500 for every student lost, which is a significant difference. So it's somewhat ironic that the major logic in the Finance Committee used by the three Republicans who voted against it was the loss of funding to the public schools, yet it was the Finance Committee amendment that removed the most ambitious approach to keeping the public schools whole. So no one's exactly sure why that came down that way.
Okay. The latest machinations on the school choice bill, one of many things to happen at the State House this week, to put it mildly. A few other pieces of legislation to talk about this morning. Among them, HB 1264, State Senate passed it, which would merge the definitions of domicile and residency for voting purposes. Democrats say Republicans who are generally supportive of the bill are trying to suppress the voices of college students. Republicans say Democrats are pushing false narratives of the bill. Was this move expected, Casey?
I think so, yes. I think that one of the most kind of consistent patterns that we've seen this year, and I think last year as well, is the kind of, you know, expected partisan divide when it comes to these issues around voting legislation, particularly when it comes to defining who should be eligible to vote and whether or not the state needs to have some kind of stricter standards for determining whether or not someone actually, you know, has lived in New Hampshire a sufficient amount of time or has taken sufficient steps, either through registering their car, getting a driver's license, you know, doing other things that may, you know, kind of formalize their relationship with the state in order to be able to vote here. So, as you said, HB 1264 is one of a pair of bills that deals with this kind of question of domicile and residency. So just as a refresher, because it kind of gets lost in the debate, domicile is kind of, you know, the place that you, you know, believe to be your home at the, you know, above all others. And you can have, you know, several different residences. Perhaps, you know, maybe you live, you have a house in California, maybe you have a house in New Hampshire, maybe you have a house in Florida. But, you know, you're supposed to choose only one of those as your domicile. And what this does is removes a piece of language from the statutory definition of who is a state resident. So this applies not just to questions of voting, but also potentially to lots of other questions around state laws that are dependent upon residency definition. So it removes this phrase for the indefinite future. So that means that basically they're looking to say that you have to, you know, believe New Hampshire to be, you know, the one place that you call your home, not for the indefinite future, just like end the sentence there. Mm-hmm. So they're saying that the supporters are saying that doing this is just merely, you know, bringing New Hampshire's laws in line with other states, that, you know, a lot of other New England states have similar definitions in place. At the same time, there was an acknowledgement, I think, during some of the hearings on the bill, even from supporters, that this would require, you know, for example, someone who is maybe in college here to perhaps register their car here. And that's where critics of the bill have a real problem, because they say that in doing that, that's essentially setting up a system where you would be asking someone to incur extra expenses or extra burdens as a condition of choosing to vote here.
Yeah. Well, one of the interesting things about this that I read about in the Union Leader, I believe, Dave, was that it's difficult to identify how this would be enforced. I mean, the DMV doesn't seem to think that this they have anything to do with this.
Well, the point is often raised by supporters of the bill that what's wrong with having a residency requirement? There's a residency requirement in Maine. There's one in Vermont. There's one in Massachusetts. But what was never said is that those residency requirements are not linked to motor vehicle law. In other words, the great argument of opponents of this bill is that it creates what they call a poll tax, whereby a student who says, okay, I'll declare residency because I live in the dorm and I want to vote, can be told, but remember, if you do that, you're going to have to go change your car registration to New Hampshire. You're going to have to go to the DMV and get a New Hampshire driver's license. And this sets up the scenario that is perceived as having the potential to really discourage student voting, because they're going to say, well, I don't want to go through all that. I'm going back to the dorm. What the other states that have imposed a residency requirement around us do is they specifically exempt students from the requirement to comply with motor vehicle laws after they've declared residency. In Maine, the Secretary of State has made clear that there is no cross-enforcement of election law and motor vehicle law, and that declaring residency does not compel you to obtain a Maine documentation for your motor vehicle, despite the reminders by the Republican governor and, in more recently, the Republican mayor of Lewiston, trying to tell students that they would have to do that. Now, in Vermont, they have a specific exclusion. The law defining residency actually has a carve-out where it says transient voters, such as students, farm workers, and others, are not residents for purposes of motor vehicle law, but they are residents for purposes of voting. Hmm. So these are ways these laws are parsed to prevent these outcomes in blue states. So to point to our neighbors as having residency laws similar to what's being proposed here is not consistent. And there's no plan for cross-enforcement here in New Hampshire. I interviewed all of the parties involved in this earlier in the week, and the Secretary of State confirmed we have no plan to turn over new registration identity to the DMV to go into a 60-meter ticket system. And the DMV says we have no intention of enforcing election law. So the student advocates say, well, that's small comfort because people tend to want to follow the law whether they think it's going to be enforced or not. So if these students go into the polling stations and there's a big sign that says once you declare residency, you have to get a license, they're going to follow the logic of that.
Well, you know, it looks like we're going to get something out of the state legislature, and then the question is, will Governor Sununu sign it? And if you remember, after SB 3 was passed, Governor Sununu said that that was enough and that he liked the rules the way they were at this point. He didn't foresee any additional changes. And as we know, SB 3 went to the courts, and it was allowed to stand, but the financial penalties were blocked. We don't know where he is on this. He has said consistently that he's not happy with either bill in its current shape. That doesn't mean he won't sign some version of it. So there's a lot of pressure on him. He's been filmed on video saying that he doesn't like the idea of these bills at one point. But we don't really know what he's going to do. And as Dave mentioned, you know, this will end up in the courts, and they will argue that it's excluding a group of voters and that it's essentially a poll tax. And I think that's where the debate will end up inevitably if Governor Sununu does sign a version of this. But we're all kind of waiting for him to articulate a little bit more what exactly it is about these that he doesn't like.
And here's what we've heard from Governor Sununu so far, courtesy of political reporter Paul Steinhauser.
You know, I don't want to tell the House and the Senate exactly what to do. The Committee of Conference process is always pretty interesting. I'm not sure what changes they're looking for on their end. But in its current form, it's nothing that I can support right now. But I'm hopeful that they can find a good resolution.
Governor Sununu hoping for a good resolution. Casey.
I have yet to receive any answers from the governor's office about what specifically he would like to see changed in the bill. Right. I've asked repeatedly and haven't gotten any answers to those questions. I also haven't gotten an answer as to whether he plans to veto it if it doesn't change sufficiently to his liking. So I think to the extent that, you know, as Dean said, you know, he signaled kind of broadly earlier in the session that he wasn't pleased with this. And I think is walking a kind of fine line here in terms of not wanting to come off as being, you know, overly restrictive when it comes to election laws, but also, you know, frankly, has a Republican base to satisfy on this that is clamoring for more kind of rules
it's
around
this. It's fascinating to me listening to that quote that clip you just played. There's no information in it. He essentially said, well, the conference committee, they'll come up with something eventually. I don't want to really tell them what to do. I don't really like it, but I'm not going to tell you what exactly I don't like. It's sort of a non-answer, and I think he's kind of gaming things to see where they're going to end up precisely because of the political dilemma that this has put him in.
Yeah, just to kind of hammer that home, the extent to which there hasn't really been a lot of substance to the governor's official positions on this.
I keep looking. I haven't seen anything.
I've asked repeatedly, and the last two times that I've gotten a response from the governor's office, it's been the exact same response verbatim both times. The governor's position has not changed. He has serious concerns with both House Bill 372 and House Bill 1264 and does not support either bill in their current form. But again, no, you know, extra elaboration there.
Okay. You got to wonder if opponents of this bill were so upset about the possibility of disenfranchising college students, would they have been pleased with a carve out similar to those that exist in other states that say, okay, let's do this, but exempt college students and exempt other transient people? Any indication?
Well, some change like that, perhaps in conference committee, would certainly give the governor cover to sign the bills without question. And if Republicans truly are not trying to disenfranchise students from voting, then they should have no objection to that. But it would have to happen in conference committee because neither version of the House or Senate passed bills contains anything like that. And in fact, they're very similar. So if Governor Sununu expects to see something different, it's not going to be coming about because of the Senate and the House reconciling any differences in the two bills they pass, because they're almost identical. It would have to emerge almost organically in the conference committee discussions.
All right. Well, this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange. We're speaking with Dave Solomon of the union leader, NHPR's Casey McDermott, and Dean Spiliotis. Still to come, a new poll shows that voters in New Hampshire's 2nd Congressional District have an appetite for a candidate who is not incumbent Democrat Annie Custer. If you are a CD2 voter, tell us, who do you want to vote for and why? Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, or email exchange at nhpr.org. We'll be right back.
Spring is just about here, and Morning Edition is hitting the road. In our new weekly series, we're traveling across the Granite State to take you to new places and introduce you to new people.
Yeah, the moon looks very cinematic. What are we expecting to see tonight? Now, people come here to see the alpacas. Homebrewers starting out, how do you get from just whipping up batches in your basement to opening up your own tasting room?
Listen to Radio Field Trips, Morning Edition's new series about New Hampshire life and culture, Wednesday mornings from 5 to 9 on NHPR.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, here in the studio with Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU and author of the website NH Political Capital, Dave Solomon of the union leader, and NHPR's Casey McDermott. We were just speaking briefly about the legislation that would merge the definitions of domicile and residency. We got an email from Nancy who writes, if the legislature wants to demand driver's licenses of students, then they need to bring back local DMV offices. Right now, a Dartmouth student would need to go to Newport to get a license. As to the school voucher thing, well, we'll get to the school voucher thing in a minute. But what about that? DMV offices, not exactly easy to get to in the state. That's not something I've heard of before, but not necessarily true.
DMV offices have closed over the years. The most prominent shrinkage, of course, being in Milford, which you'd think would be a substantial enough community to have a DMV office for Milford and the surrounding towns, but has been hours consistently restricted. It's hard to get to a DMV office, and with all due respect to the wonderful DMV employees, it's probably one of the most undesirable experiences because it's a long wait, and you invariably don't have the right paperwork and invariably have a challenging experience. So having the requirement to go to a DMV to change your license when it's not something you necessarily feel you need to do for your long-term purposes is no small matter.
And her follow-up question about school vouchers, Nancy says, I'm absolutely disgusted if they try to bring it back again. It has been defeated. Why don't they listen to the people? We have certainly been talking to our reps. Okay, so that's from Nancy. And we're bringing it back because maybe the result will be different if more legislators actually show up for the vote. Is that the idea?
Yeah, I think the attendance was really, a disgrace, frankly, to have 50 representatives not present on 2 days of the most critical voting of the session does not speak well to the dedication of some of these people that run for office, quite frankly. You need to be there on days like that. And I think with better attendance, you could get a result. It wasn't all Republicans who were missing, but a significant number of them were.
And one last comment about the voucher program, the Freedom Scholarship legislation. Roger from Concord wrote in to recommend, you want choice, you have it in the town you choose to live in. You have it in the local school district through your vote, your voice, and your commitment to volunteer and your choice to run for school board. Stop trying to supersede the Constitution by diverting public funds to private institutions and instead embrace and improve the bedrock of American democracy, public education for all. Roger goes on to say, vouchers is on an elitist agenda and not in the best interest of America. Thanks very much for your comments, Roger. We appreciate it. We're going to go through a lot more pieces of legislation in this hour because it has been a busy week in Concord and throughout the state, actually. One of the other pieces of legislation that advanced this week was the animal cruelty legislation. House and Senate now have two different versions of this bill. Casey, are you familiar with this?
Yeah. So basically, this all stems from that kind of, very high profile case involving Christina Fey in Wolfboro, who was, I believe, found guilty earlier this year having mistreating, 84 Great Danes, got international headlines, and provoked a lot of kind of reexamination more locally about the statutes around New Hampshire's handling of animal abuse and the kind of tools that are available to investigate and prosecute those cases. So there was some kind of back and forth over this bill. The Senate passed a version of it earlier this year, but by the time it got to the House, there were several changes that were made to it to kind of exempt various kinds of breeders from the version that was approved by the Senate, as well as to introduce a new kind of provision that addressed animal hoarding. That raised some questions among people because animal hoarding can at times be a signal of, mental health concerns, and people were concerned about criminalizing mental illness if you go too hard on that. So it was interesting as well. My colleague Todd Bookman had a fairly in-depth story on the kind of emerging debate of this prior to the vote earlier this week. And he said that he's gotten more email on this than probably anything else this session, which I think says a lot considering all of the other topics that we've talked about, from, school choice to Medicaid expansion to voting rights, that this is something that people are being fairly vocal on. He was kind of the champion of the earlier version of the bill and was unhappy with the version that was kind of, for lack of a better term, kind of neutered by this amendment once it got through the House. So I think that it remains to be seen how this will be resolved once it gets to the Committee of Conference. But there are some substantial areas of disagreement in terms of the bill that was approved this week.
Yeah, an additional area of agreement is over who bears the cost of taking care of the animals while the legal process is running. The Great Dane example, that cost run into hundreds of thousands of dollars to take care of those animals. So that's another aspect of this. And, the original intention of the Senate bill was to have more stringent standards for commercial breeding and to put limits on the number of litters you can have in a year and things like that. And there's a feeling that the House bill has weakened or undercut that. And, from everything I've heard and read, there's some real concern that the two bills are so far apart that a conference may not be able to agree on some sort of compromise legislation. And so they seem to be, the two chambers seem to be working at a little bit at cross purposes to each other.
Well, Dave?
You keep in mind that if the conference committee fails to come to an agreement, the status quo prevails, which would in effect be a victory for the House position, because it doesn't really substantially change the status quo in this area of animal cruelty and who bears the financial responsibility when animals have to be removed and tended to for months at a time while a case works its way through the courts. So this is one of three or one of several examples where the House and the Senate are completely at odds, having passed bills that are 180 degrees opposite from each other. And either one side is going to prevail or the status quo is going to prevail. And in each case, the status quo benefits one side or the other. So there's not a lot of incentive to negotiate. That's the case with this animal rights bill and several others that are going to conference committee.
Well, as this fight continues, listeners, if you've got lingering questions, send them exchange@nhpr.org. We're going to be focusing on this animal cruelty legislation on the Exchange on Tuesday. Again, you can send your questions in advance to exchange@nhpr.org. Or you can give us a call now about questions you have about the week's news, 1-800-892-6477. Later in the show, we're going to be talking about Medicaid expansion. Lawmakers approved it for another 2.5 years, and we want to know what you think about that. 1-800-892-6477. Another bit of legislation this week that we should talk about is that the New Hampshire House sided with town election officials in an ongoing debate over who should have the final say in rescheduling local elections. This came after 2 years in a row. We got big snowstorms on town meeting day in March. At the center of this debate, of course, was the power of the Secretary of State. Casey, you've been covering this. So How much power would Bill Gardner, Secretary of State Bill Gardner, have under this House bill for postponing elections?
So this one would give him substantially less power. As I read it earlier this week, the version that was approved as amended by the House would basically require just notification, not a request to move the date of the election, which is the process that was spelled out in an earlier bill and a process that was reiterated in a an amendment that was brought forward to address some of the concerns that were raised by local officials in light of the more recent snowstorm that happened since the Senate approved it last year. So it's, I think it's interesting that this has been kind of a, textbook example of a debate over local versus state control. I think it's also interesting to see the extent to which, and, you can only kind of speculate on this, that the blizzard that descended right before the town meeting day this year may have had a significant impact on the outcome of the House vote, because the Senate voted before that happened, and they were addressing basically something that had happened almost a year ago prior. So it was kind of, I think, less fresh in people's minds. There was a lot of lobbying at that point on the part of municipal officials and the Municipal Association, as well as the Secretary of State's office and others, who felt that it was most appropriate to provide some level of state oversight to that decision-making process. But showing up to the hearing that happened once it got into the House after it passed the Senate, there were a ton of local election officials and local officials just generally who came out to basically say, listen, we're the ones on the ground. We should be the ones who have the authority to make this decision on the fly. There can be a lot of kind of variables that, the weather in Concord is different than the weather in Berlin. And we should be the ones who can, make that decision and make that call for our voters. So that seems to have resounded with the House.
Yeah, this is another one of those bills where the House and Senate, again, are 180 degrees apart. Mm-hmm. The Senate passed a bill that essentially says the Secretary of State gets the last word. And the House passed a bill that said, no, as regards just the town election, just for selectmen, planning board, we're not talking state rep, Congress, or anything. Those local elections, the moderators should be able to postpone. So that there is no middle ground there to be had that I can see. So here again, if the status quo prevails, that's a victory for the Senate side, because the status quo, as evidenced by the most recent election, is that the Attorney General, the governor, all agree that the Secretary of State should have the final say, and they're actually taking action to penalize a North Country town that did postpone its election. So the current position of the state is that the Secretary of State has final say. So the Senate has no incentive, if it's that hot for its position in conference committee, to do anything except let the matter die. So this is what happens when you get into this conference committee season of the next week. You're going to have discussions like, well, if you want our animal cruelty bill, you're going to have to take our election bill, and back and forth it's going to go.
Wow. Okay. Going to be a complicated debate then. With respect to Medicaid expansion, Casey, Medicaid expansion approved for another 2.5 years. How did this debate play out?
Frankly, it was somewhat anticlimactic, given the kind of debate that we've seen over the last few years over this. Recall that, this bill, I believe, passed for the first time in 2014, the result of much legislative maneuvering at the time with then-Governor Maggie Hassan, Republican leadership in the Senate. Senate Majority Leader Jeb Bradley has been kind of the steward of the, the plans that have passed each time around as kind of, a bridge builder between Democrats who generally are on board with the concept of Medicaid expansion, period, and Republicans who are likely to be more skeptical of the program, both from the standpoint of, being less eager to expand kind of publicly provided health coverage, but also concerned about the fiscal burden that may be placing on either the federal or the state government in doing so. So that's all to say that I think there was a lot of legwork done, and frankly, a lot of it done behind the scenes before the bill that we saw this year was even brought forward. So they hashed out, I think, a lot of their disagreements before it even was introduced. And that, I think, avoided a lot of the kind of public squabbling that we may have seen in years past. So they were able to basically introduce this bill. It included a work requirement, which I think was a an olive branch to Republicans who might be more skeptical of continuing the program, because they added kind of a layer of, okay, we're going to add some expectation that people are going to be expected to still be engaged in their communities. This isn't just a free handout to people, which is some of the language that you sometimes hear from its critics. They also added a new funding mechanism that is designed, according to supporters, to insulate the state from having to spend extra state tax dollars on the program. So they would draw from the state alcohol fund, and they have a plan to backfill the state alcohol fund with the money that they would be taking out of there. So there were a lot of kind of new provisions to address some of the concerns that they've had over years past. There was a lot of lobbying done on the part of both health groups, kind of advocacy groups around substance abuse recovery, business groups. There was a pretty broad coalition that supported this. So I think by the time it finally came around on Thursday, I would say the vote was it was introduced and done within, I think, maybe 10 minutes or so. There was barely any floor debate.
The vote to adopt an amendment related to the bill was like 300 and something to 19. And the vote on the bill itself was a voice vote. Yeah. I don't think any of us expected Medicaid expansion to be renewed for the third time on a voice vote after there had been votes by which it survived only a one-vote margin in some of the previous years. So this has been a complete turnaround in the political environment surrounding this element of Obamacare, which is essentially what it is. And it was a key component of Obamacare that we expand eligibility for Medicaid to embrace that portion of the population not poor enough to qualify for traditional Medicaid, but not well off enough to afford policies on the exchange. So the fact that it has cleared with such a bipartisan consensus is Casey said, a demonstration of the fact that all of this was hammered out in a Medicaid expansion commission that has met over the past year, led by Majority Leader Jeb Bradley and Democratic Senator Dan Feltes, who spoke together in front of the State House to a crowd of supporters the day before the vote was taken, and were widely and jointly applauded. And even the Democratic leader in the House said this is an example of how big bipartisan legislation needs to be done.
And what's interesting is the renewal is switching from buying on the private market to a managed care model, and that private market model had been a big part of the initial Republican compromise to get this thing through when it was much more controversial. And it's been fascinating to me to watch Governor Sununu's kind of evolution on the issue. When he ran for governor in 2016, he was very noncommittal about Medicaid expansion. I think seeing the impact of the attempts to repeal Obamacare early on in the Trump administration and learning more about the impact it has on people in the state and the overlap with the opioid crisis, the population overlap, I think all of those things have kind of changed his thinking on it. And he's almost a champion of it at this point. And I think the work requirement is something the Republicans really like. It kind of gives them some buy-in to the process. But it is amazing to me, remembering how difficult an issue this was early on, to see now that everybody seems comfortable with it.
Yeah, I think, too, just to speak to kind of the governor's evolving position on it, I think it also speaks to just the change that takes place from any politician from when they're a candidate to when they are actually elected and in a position where, you know, if you step back and think about the program, it covers right now roughly 52,000 people. And if they were not to renew the program this year, it's really unclear what, if any, kind of backup plan there is for making sure that those people have health coverage. So I think from the standpoint of, you know, if you're a public official, there's these 52,000 people who are relying on this program for health coverage. And if you don't act, that's going to go away. Those people are not only going to be, you know, angry, but also sick and, you know, in trouble and affecting the rest of the state's healthcare system. That kind of ups the stakes for supporting something like this.
Mm-hmm. So really quickly, Casey, after 2.5 years, what happens then? Do they have to do this all again?
And I've heard conflicting language on this, but if you actually look at the bill, basically, initially the plan was proposed as a 5-year blanket reauthorization. This one is 2.5 years. A commission is going to decide at that point whether or not to reauthorize it for another 2.5 years, but it's not going to be the legislature again.
Okay. Well, this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, and we're speaking with journalists today about the week's news. It was a very busy week in the news. If you have questions or comments about what's been going on in New Hampshire this week, give us a call. The number is 1-800-892-6477. You can post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange as well. In the next part of the program, we will be talking about the Old Man of the Mountain. It's been 15 years since it crumbled. Very sad moment in New Hampshire history. What are your memories of the Old Man of the Mountain? Give us a call. 1-800-892-6477. Or send an email, exchange@nhpr.org. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, here in the studio with Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU and the author of the website NH Political Capital, NHPR's Casey McDermott, and Dave Solomon of The Union Leader. And with you, we'd love to hear from you on the week's news. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Let's turn to CD2 for a moment, Congressional District Number 2 in New Hampshire, where Democratic incumbent Annie Custer will face one of several Republicans running in the primary. A new poll shows that 45% of those polled say that it's time to give someone else a chance in CD2. What do you make of that, Dean?
This is an interesting poll. I think the more important number is that I believe in the poll, her favorability is still at 45%, which is a pretty good level for a member of Congress. The issue with these House seats is that they tend to really be driven by national politics more than any other major elective office in the state. So, you know, Annie Custer is very well funded. She's facing three challengers: Steve Negrin, a businessman from Nashua; Stuart Levinson, who's best known as a VA whistleblower; Lynn Blankenbecker, a former member of the state legislature. So none of those folks are going to have particularly high name recognition for your typical voter. This 2018 is shaping up likely to be a good year for Democrats. That seat has trended increasingly Democratic. It's not a guaranteed Democratic seat, but compared to 15 or 20 years ago, it's much more favorable to Democrats. So, you know, I think she's in reasonably good shape. I think a lot of it's going to be dictated by the larger dynamics in the state. And if this is, as expected, a good year for Democrats, I think she's in reasonably good shape. I'm not really sure what the poll means by give someone else a chance. I mean, typically you're either an incumbent or a challenger, and you get voted in or out. And I don't know how that breaks down among Democrats and Republicans. But if, in fact, you know, her favorability is in the 40s for a House seat, that's in that district, I think that's reasonably good.
Sure. I think the poll results speak to a growing public sentiment that's been a factor for a good 10 years or more now, which is kind of a throw the bums out mentality, which is incumbency has almost become a disadvantage. It's identified you as part of the problem. With Congress being so unpopular, historically, Congress has always been unpopular collectively, but polls have shown individuals like their congressperson. Now that unpopularity of Congress has become so toxic, it's now starting to filter down to the individual congressman. And, you know, we once valued incumbency and seniority and the advantages it brought to the districts that were represented, but more and more the dynamic is becoming we need turnover in these positions, and I think we're seeing it in these poll results.
Well, you can't really have, unless we amend the Constitution, you're not going to have term limits in Congress. So it's really up to voters to do that. But again, I think, you know, if you look at the lay of the land for this next election, I think she's in reasonably good shape.
I think It's also important to remind people that we are 6 months away from the election still, and sure, there's a lot that could, I mean, for in either direction. So I think that, like, you know, as a reporter who sees a lot of these polls coming in, particularly over the last week or so, there seems to be a flurry of them. You know, I kind of read those with a grain of salt. I'm interested in kind of the longitudinal, like, over time favorability numbers and looking at maybe how those change in response to maybe public sentiment. But in terms of predicting any kind of outcome, I think we're way too far out.
I'm just sort of thinking off the top of my head, but you typically, for members of the House, you don't see the kinds of popularity and approval and favorability that you might see for a state senator, you know, a U.S. senator like Jean Shaheen or Maggie Hassan. Or even for a Republican,
As well, though, I do think, you know, it's worth pointing out that last time around in 2016, you know, granted, there was a bit of a Republican bump across the state, but I think the margin was a little bit tighter than I was expecting it to be between Congresswoman Custer and the challenger, Jim Lawrence, who had a lot of issues. And I frankly did not have the name recognition that you would expect, you know, just looking at the margins. So I don't think anything is set in stone right now. And I think that, again, you know, we have a long way to go until the election.
And we'll be looking at CD2 next Monday at 9:40 on the Exchange. So if you have questions about the candidates aiming to take on incumbent Annie Custer in the primary, send them to us now by email. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. Still have a lot of stories to talk about this hour. Among them, Senator Shaheen came out with her endorsement of Democratic gubernatorial candidate Molly Kelly. Kelly is facing Steve Marchand in the Democratic primary for governor. Casey, why did Senator Shaheen say she was supporting Molly Kelly?
Well, the senator cited, you know, Kelly's experience, her track record in the legislature, as well as otherwise. And I think that, you know, it is worth noting that, at least to my knowledge, the senator did not previously come out and endorse this early and past gubernatorial primaries on the Democratic side. That being said, I think it's fairly obvious to anyone who is following this race very closely that the kind of establishment wing of the Democratic Party is not particularly thrilled with Steve Marchand. And, you know, to the extent that Senator Shaheen is kind of the matriarch of the establishment wing, and that many of her supporters would be likely lining up behind former Senator Kelly, this was, I think, pretty obvious that it was going to happen at some point, even if we weren't, you know, necessarily expecting it this early.
Mm-hmm. So is this going to give Molly Kelly a huge lift, Dean?
I think it certainly helps. It's interesting. I would be interested to hear more about the extent to which some of these establishment folks were instrumental in actually kind of encouraging her into the race, because they sure did line up behind her very quickly. And Steve has been, you know, toiling away at this for a long time, going around the state doing retail events and trying to build you know, visibility. And, you know, that governor's race, whether it's Marchand or Kelly up against Sununu. You know, Sununu's in reasonably good shape. He's got good favorability. He's done a pretty good job of catering to both Republicans and independents. It's just going to depend on kind of how turnout is. And if it's a big blue wave, you know, maybe he'll be like John Lynch in 2010 with the Tea Party, where Lynch was kind of the last Democrat standing, or maybe it'll be a big enough wave to knock him out. But I think it'll be a good race, regardless of whether or not it's Marchand or Kelly. But it is interesting to me, and kind of indicative of the situation, that they've lined up so quickly behind Kelly when Steve has been at this for months and months.
It's worth noting, too, at least my understanding is that Steve Marchand previously sought the U.S. Senate seat against then U.S. Senator John E. Sununu, and that at that point there was some speculation as to whether or not Senator Shaheen was going to enter the race, and that there was some kind of unhappiness that he jumped in before, you know, she had made a decision on that. So there's a little bit of a history behind the candidates as well. I can't speak to the extent to which that factored into this particular decision, but I think it's just working. It's worth pointing out that, you know, there have been maybe, you know, areas of disagreement between their supporters before.
Okay. Let's turn our attention briefly to CD1, because we've got a few more candidates in this race. No shortage of choice for voters living in CD1. The newest entry, Naomi Andrews. Who is she?
She's Carol Shea Porter's chief of staff. She's, I think, run a couple campaigns for Carol Shea Porter. She, I think, becomes the eighth Democrat to get into the race, something like that. She put up a video announcing, you know, that she would sort of provide good continuity for members of the residents of the first district, and in particular for people who support Carol Shea Porter. I'm not sure how many people saw it coming, but it makes a very complicated Democratic primary even a little bit more so.
And she released a video as part of her campaign announcement. Let's hear a little bit of that.
I've worked for Carol for over a decade, and I share her love for people and her determination to fight for the rest of us. As her chief of staff, I worked each day on all of the national and state issues, in addition to the challenges facing us in New Hampshire.
And in that video, she goes on to talk about, you know, advocating for the middle class, which is something we're hearing a lot from the Democrats this time around, perhaps as a response to accusations that they weren't focusing enough on the middle class in the 2016 election. Is that something you've been hearing as well, Dean?
Sure, absolutely. I think, and you heard in that video, as I suggested, an argument in favor of continuity. And it's interesting to me, you do occasionally see around the country when members of Congress retire, you may see a chief of staff or a senior advisor jump into the race occasionally, and that's usually based on kind of their experience in working with the prior member. So we'll see what kind of an impact it has. There really hasn't been any polling per se of that race, or much, if any at all. And when you have that many people in a race, it's kind of difficult to figure out exactly what's going to happen. But there's certainly no shortage of options for Democrats in that September primary.
Yeah, another option to enter the race this week was Hampton Tech executive Bruce Crochetier. He entered the race. We're having this series called Race for the First on The Exchange on NHPR. We usually do that on Mondays. It's not going to happen next week, but stay tuned for more conversations with CD1 candidates. Let's just hope there's enough Mondays between now and the election to actually have all the candidates in. Yeah, so let's talk about a few other stories this week that were important. One of them was the balanced billing story. Casey, you were following this since the very beginning, and now it seems like legislators have rallied to end this kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, this was, I think, probably one of the most bipartisan initiatives that we've seen this entire session. It passed, I believe, by a margin. I forget the number in support, but I believe there were only like five dissenters whenever it passed the House, which is like a huge margin. And then once it got to the Senate, it passed unanimously. And basically what this looks to do is to add additional protections for patients if, say, hypothetically, I go to an emergency room at a hospital that I believe to be in my insurance network, but somewhere along the way in my care during that ER visit, a doctor is sent to me who isn't technically part of my insurance network. And then I get a bill after the fact for the cost of their care. This happens pretty frequently and has gained a lot of attention both nationally and locally as people have kind of spoken out with their own stories at local hospitals. So there was a bill that was workshopped over a number of months last year with input from the insurance department and others. It has the endorsement of the insurance department, which is pretty rare. They generally just provide kind of information on bills and will very rarely actually take a legislative position, but they felt that this was a really important consumer issue to get behind. It had the endorsement of the governor. He plans to sign it if it comes to his desk. So I think that, you know, this is kind of an interesting development. I think it'll be interesting to watch now how it actually functions. It only applies in certain circumstances, so only in ER care, anesthesiology, pathology, and radiology. But people said that those were chosen because those tend to be areas where people most frequently encounter that practice. Yeah, so it'll be interesting to see how that actually is put into effect on the patient and hospital level.
Okay.
There was a lot of support because most people figured the purpose of managed care was if consumers agree to stay within their network and keep costs down, it benefits everybody. But if providers are going to have the option of bouncing consumers out of network without even telling them and then billing them accordingly, it defeats the whole purpose of managed care philosophy.
Yeah. One last story to discuss this week. This week is a sad anniversary for Granite Staters. 15 years ago, the old man of the mountain came tumbling down overnight. The anniversary was yesterday on Thursday. Earlier, I asked listeners to call in with their stories about the old man of the mountain. We get a call from Cheryl in Lebanon. Cheryl, tell us your story.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. And so my story is about 25 years ago, when our children were 7 and 5, they're now 32 and 30 respectively, we enjoyed the magnificent view of the Old Man in the Mountain. And it's just so sad that it's gone. And I'm glad that they have that memory. And I hope the state retains that memory. And thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Cheryl. Appreciate your call. Yeah, it means a lot to a lot of Grand Estaters. Sure. It's one of those events that you sort of, if you were here in New Hampshire and or at least near New Hampshire, I wasn't in New Hampshire at the time, I was in Maine, but I remember where I was when I heard that news. And I thought, oh, that's really sad. But not being a Grand Estater natively, I didn't have strong opinions about it. But apparently those who were here did.
Absolutely. And it's been interesting just on social media. You know, there's been an outpouring of emotion and nostalgia here in New Hampshire. And I think, is, you know, other folks from outside of the state in the social media universe have been a little bit amused by the whole thing and kind of surprised at how intensely people feel that. I remember the first time I saw it driving up north, and it's pretty cool. It, you know, from the naked eye, it looks a little further away than I think I expected. But you hit just the right angle, and it really looked like a face, a man's face popping out of the mountain. And I think, and it's been a big kind of part of our tourism lore, and it was a, I think, a big loss for people.
Yeah, I mean, it was always the spirit of the man in the mountain that was most important to the state body politic and its whole culture, not so much the physical existence. So it still exists as a symbol of the state. And the quote that up there in New Hampshire, they make men out of granite, using the term man to speak of people in general, still speaks to the just that flinty, solid, hardworking, granite-like personality of the New Hampshire people, and that lives on, even though the Old Man in the Mountain fell to the forces of gravity.
And I don't think I've been in an antique store in New Hampshire where I haven't found a big box of Man of the Mountain postcards from vintage ones, everything. Yeah,
he lives on.
In state highway signs on
postcards,
the New Hampshire quarter.
It's
still there. And, you know, if the spirit isn't good enough for you, you can always go to the spot. And there's apparently little silhouettes or iron sort of shapes that you can look at.
There was a lot of consideration over how we were going to replace that. And they came to that decision on the visitor center with those images you described.
Yeah. Well, I haven't been, but I'd like to go. Casey, did you ever see it before?
No, I was, I think, in middle school whenever it fell. And back in my home state of Pennsylvania. So I unfortunately can't speak firsthand. But I can say as a transplant, I'm kind of, I said this on Twitter yesterday in response to a column I read about it. I'm like equal parts perplexed and fascinated by like the ongoing devotion to the Old Man of the Mountain. I know he means a lot to a lot of people. As someone who's still acclimating to the Granite State, I'm still learning about that. And so it's this anniversary has been an opportunity to really delve into that a little bit more deeply.
Well, Old Man of the Mountain, you are missed, certainly. Well, that's it for today. I want to thank our panel of esteemed reporters and analysts, Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences in SNHU, author of the website NH Political Capital, NHPR's Casey McDermott, and Dave Solomon of the Union Leader. Thank you all very much for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks, Peter.
Thanks.
And remember, you can find a link to all of the stories that we discussed today at nhpr.org. And this conversation continues online on Facebook and at our website, nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. And our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening and have a great weekend.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.